Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the June 2023 edition of Poet Radio. My name is Chris Funkhauser, host of this program on WGXC since 2015. This month's show features a reading I attended earlier this month at the Noah Webster House in West Hartford, Connecticut, part of a series titled Word House, organized by Jim Finnegan, to whom I send out gratitude for putting the Word House events together. This reading, at first, caught my attention because one of the readers was Charles O. Hartman, a poet and musician who I first knew and appreciated as a computer programmer who wrote a fantastic book titled Virtual Muse, which was about his experiments in computer poetry. Over the years, I used Hartman's program, PyProse, to create many texts and wrote about his work in my monograph, Prehistoric Digital Poetry. If you look around on the internet, you can also find an interview I did with Charles on the Italian website Utsanga. Beyond the opportunity to hear Hartman, the reading served to introduce me to another Connecticut poet, Deborah Kuan, whose work is new to me. I will be playing both poets' sets here, beginning with Kuan's. Deborah Kuan is the author of three poetry books, including a forthcoming volume, Women on the Moon, from WordWorks Books. At present, she is Poet Laureate of Wallingford, Connecticut. I am very pleased to be presenting her poems on the program.
Thank you so much, Jim. It's an honor to be here and to be reading with Charles. And I know that you guys are all genuine poetry fans because after being inside due to toxic smoke for 3 days, you're back inside on a beautiful day. One of the most beautiful days I think we've had all year. So thank you so much, and it was wonderful hearing all of you read. So I'm going to read a little bit from my second book, Lunch Portraits. This is a long poem at the end of the book that is in homage to Joe Brainard's book, I Remember. And if you're not familiar with that book, it was an entire book of memories of his childhood. And he was a white gay man. And to sort of claim American for myself, I wrote a poem mimicking that book. And it's called 121 Memories of an American Childhood. So it's a list poem, and I hear you're only allowed one of these in your career. So this is mine. 121 Memories of an American Childhood. Sharpening a brand new pencil on a mechanical pencil sharpener as loudly as possible. Metallic compasses, double Velcro sneakers, cheap white athletic socks that thinned at the toe and heel. Grass stains on the plaid polyester pants my grandmother sewed me. My hide-and-seek spot behind musty garment bags and boots in the closet. The ginkgo tree on the flat side of our front yard, the oak tree on the hilly side. Snapping cicada shells off the oak tree and placing them on rocks in the laundry room. The cool brown and tan linoleum of the laundry room. The wallpaper of girls riding old-fashioned bicycles and playing hoops and sticks in the downstairs bathroom. The strained, lonely sound of the dining room after the dishes had been cleared and the oilcloth wiped off. The farmer in the dell. White yarn tights whose crotches drooped down my thighs. Spilling apple juice on my favorite pink plaid skirt and having to take it off in class and wait for the teacher to wash and dry it. Bathrooms in the back of the classroom. My mother under a helmet hairdryer at the JCPenney hair salon. The lingerie section in front of the hair salon. The smell of the mall escalator. The taste of kissing my forearm. Holding my chopsticks wrong. The dried goji berries my grandmother sprinkled in every soup. Fake wood paneling. The men's wallet I stored my birthday money in, then lost. My soft pink doll with a hard head that my aunt said was stuffed with marshmallows, and I believed her. My grandmother making us slurp a raw egg when we had a nosebleed. It's a miracle we didn't get salmonella, because it happened a lot. Not understanding Hogan's Heroes, not understanding MASH, candy cigarettes, candy dots, Dixie cups. The Halloween I wore a Holly Hobby mask and couldn't breathe nor see. The sadness of the day after Halloween. My mom drawing on the church program to entertain me. White girls with beautiful eyelashes and glinting eyes and full party dresses. The year we got a bunk bed and my sister and I pretended we lived on a houseboat and had to pour water out every night to survive. The plastic bags we filled with water and twist-tied closed and pretended were exotic pets. Leaving the garage door up about 6 inches every evening so my cat could slink back home at night. My grandmother calling for him, Mimi, Mimi, because she couldn't say Mickey. The dirt on the dodgeball, it's pebbly rubber. The car tires half buried in the playground that slowly sagged beneath your feet. The car tires half buried in the playground, hard as boards. The blacktop, the hard plastic-seated swings and the soft black rubber swings. Peeing hot in the cold YMCA pool. Playing half-hearted air hockey after swimming with my sister while we waited for my parents to finish drying their hair. Buying a gallon of milk at Cumberland Farms on the way home from the pool. Orange drink. Orange creamsicles from the school vending machine. Nutty Buddies. Bringing one dime in an envelope to school on pretzel day for a 10-cent Philly soft pretzel. Eating Little Debbie zebra snack cakes on an astroturfed screened-in porch after school at a friend's house on the other side of town. The sewer near the swim club, the gold-orange oil puckering on the water. My father's miniature beers in the refrigerator, and how scandalized I felt seeing them because we were Mormon. Leaving leftovers in a Tupperware container by the pine tree in the backyard for the birds. Our silver thunderbird, the felt on the ceiling of the thunderbird billowing down on our heads. Sitting in museum telephone booths with wooden seats, pretending to make a phone call. Sucking on honeysuckle from the bushes behind the schoolyard. Big sanitary napkins in plain cardboard boxes. And I'll skip to the end. Taking a standardized test with a fever. Wanting a station wagon. Putting floral sheets on our couches to protect them from the sun. Picking out a toy from the dentist's foam-lined treasure chest. My dad's lap when he was Santa Claus at the Chinese Community Center, and the delicious secret of knowing it was him. Lying by the Christmas tree and gazing at my funhouse reflection in an ornament. So now I'll read from the new book. So technically this book is not out yet. It's out September 15th, that's the official pub date. But I have advanced author copies and a couple back there if you're interested. And the book is also available for pre-order on the WordWorks website. So this book is structured in four sections that reflect the phases of the moon. And I go backwards. So the first section is motherhood. The second section is coupling. And the third section is childhood. And the fourth is being. So if you believe in karma, as I do, you cycle back and you go back to being born again. But I wanted to start with mothering because that was the doorway to a lot of this book. And this first section I'm going to read from is the motherhood section. And this poem is called Intentions. 6 months pregnant, I go to the eyeglass shop to tighten the corners of my glasses. But the man who attempts to help me snaps off one wing by mistake and cannot reattach the hinge. With apology, he returns my life to me, and I hold it in my hands, a crippled, sighing sparrow. Lunchtime faces near and recede, plates of melted custard, a pissarro of emphatic chatter, as I retrace the way I came, fledgling slow, a glass piano on the floor of the sea, my body braced for whatever softness I should meet. So interspersed among, hi Julie, interspersed among all these poems are poems where I imagine myself as the Chinese moon goddess Tang E. You might be familiar with her. I think she's the most popular figure from Chinese legend in the West. But the legend is that she thwarted. Let me go back. So Tang E was married to Ho Yi, who was a legendary archer. And the legend goes that there was a time in the world when there were 10 suns, and it was oppressively hot because it was far too much light and far too much heat. And the emperor asked Ho Yi to shoot down 9 of the suns, leaving just the one that we have now. And so he did that, and he was rewarded for this heroic act with an immortality elixir. And he did not take the elixir right away. He left it in his home, and he was planning to take it with his wife so that the both of them could become immortal. But the apprentice, who was apprenticing with him, stole into the house and grabbed the elixir and tried to take it for himself. But Tang E, the goddess, or not the goddess yet, but the wife, thwarted him and took the elixir herself. But she didn't want to be immortal without her husband, so she took residence on the moon, a kind of halfway purgatory between Earth and the heavens. And so that metaphor of being in purgatory and being sort of alienated from Earth, being isolated, I thought was a really apt metaphor for motherhood, especially new motherhood. So there are moon goddess poems scattered throughout the book in the different phases of womanhood. So this next poem is called Unsteadying Your IKEA Rug While You're Asleep with a Fever. On the carpet of your room, the zebra sun rises over the Dalmatian hills. Its rays are hyphens, Morse code, the language of closed winter roads, and the turquoise sky is teeming with its own machinery, 9 mammalian raindrops. When you were born, all these animal attentions began to coalesce. I could begin to abandon reason, since now I loved beyond it, despite it. I could ride the nerves of highways on my own utterances, writing forever, filling blanks, lassoing the muscular neck of the continent. I would always be behind my hand advancing, taking the hill an army of horses, leading us over ground as guard and guardian. And the words it scrawled on the face of the land would become our eyes, our tunnels, our codes, our beasts, our myths, our lives, our books. And this next poem is also from the mothering section. It's called Nesting. Sorry, I think I'm going to grab some tea because my throat is getting dry. Okay, Nesting. It's February and you've gone on your first cross-country trip without me. I stand in the dining room window, naked after a bath, skin still puckered, cycling through disaster scenarios. I twist in pregnant silhouette in the melodrama of without. One life within me, one life without. My thoughts practice illegibility. One moment chicken scrawl, the next cross-hatched monologue. Fixed beliefs loosen from their sockets. I hold the nested jadeite mixing bowls I found just today at an antique shop. I admire them, perfect, unchipped vessels, cradled soundly, one snugly within the other. I hold the idea of nesting soundly as the two of us began. I hold the idea of you there at the tip of the continent, image gripped by a poor connection. Mirror image of me. Come home, Mom, you cry, not yet old enough to comprehend that you are the one who is away. Just a few more days of this overly familiar precinct, this house mumbling to itself, the executive clicks of the oven, and each morning, so late, so easy, tipping open without small thunder. And then this next poem is written in the form of a Mad Lib. There's a couple of sort of kids' games as forms in the poem. So there's a Mad Lib, there's a word find, there's some fairy tales, all reminiscent of childhood. So I will read the blanks in here as blanks. Birthday month Mad Lib. Oh, so birthday month refers to my birthday is October 17th. My daughter was born October 19th, and my husband was born October 20th. So in that series, my husband obviously gets gypped because we're all so tired of eating cake at that point. My daughter actually gets obviously the most attention, but he's the third in that line, unfortunately. So this is a poem for him. Birthday month, Mad Lib. Today as you drove, I watched the rain speed upstream against my window. First it marbled like red meat, then it stripped into gills, and finally it twisted into one jittery, unending earthworm, roping singly up toward blank deity. I inquired about the field of lead trembling to the left. I pointed out the blank adjective, sheet of clouds in the distance, headed down to smother us in more bad news. Oh, I should say this was written during the Trump presidency, so a lot of bad news at that time. Imagine a bar of soap smeared across an oil painting by a drunken Verlaine. Imagine a sanatorium of convalescent light, a museum of shipwrecked plans. But then I considered the clock, which had just turned 1:23. I felt a blank, small unit of measurement of whimsy. On the radio game show, someone told a bad joke, and we both, past tense verb, at each other, crinkling our noses in distaste. We were headed home, our child asleep in the back seat, another one on the way, below my resting hands. What would I ever do without you? And this poem is called Having a Baby at 43. I was not happy about disclosing my age, but I felt that as a person who had a baby in her 40s, I should empower other women to also do the same. So I had my second child at 43. It's called Having a Baby at 43. Your body is the oldest house on the block now. Or so it feels. Its tall frame heaves from the cold push of winter. Coins of moss flake from its shoulders and collect along its feet. You don't need to ask anymore if you are beautiful. As your grandmother once said, go piao yang le, you are beautiful enough. Take your idle questions to the curb then. So what if the teenaged cashier now calls you ma'am? So what if the doctors gentled their warnings by bringing their expert mouths close, and all you could do was pray, while folding your paper gown like a shield across your lap? Good bones, good home, how tired you are, and yet how you serve. Hold yourself in the brightest regard, the quiet chandelier of the cosmos and all its whims reflected in the evening of your windows, and in this incomparable creature, the slimmest of all slim chances, whose only planet is you. And I'll read one last one from the motherhood section, because it kind of hits close to home. There's an instance in here, an image of wildfire smoke floating over from one coast to the other. And I think at the time that I wrote this, it was wildfire smoke from a California wildfire. And of course, we experienced a very frightening version of that this week from Canada. So not to raise alarm, but it's called How to Raise Children at the End of the World. And it's tongue-in-cheek, and I think it's cathartic for all, you know, for us to think about apocalypses while also tempering that fear. So this one's called How to Raise Children at the End of the World. First of all, buy time. Hoard beans. Bury your head in a heap of raw sugar if you need. At the very least, don't ever catch yourself using the phrase end of the world, please. Phrases are luxuries. They are soap operas for the unbusy parent. So are sea levels, disinformation algorithms. Do not allow your imagination to tumble down that sinkhole of midnight mirrors. Your consciousness must get on with things. Who, what, where? It must edit, redact, hunt, through your purse for the crucial white yarn Elsa braid to clip to your toddler's ponytail before she detonates. Color, connect four. Try to extract the slippery funny bone with trembling, trembling fingers. Though when you place their sopping mittens on the radiator to dry, permit yourself to pause at the makeshift shrine, at the agony of its goodness. And when they stun you with surly ingratitude, blame the lead, arsenic, and mercury that seeped into their organic baby food. Why not? But most importantly, keep vigil, as a dirigible of wildfire smoke from the other coast blithely floats past your car. How could you ever spare them what awaits? Recall that 20 years ago, when you flew out to LA to rescue your cousin from the grip of a gang, all you did was perch yourself, useless, on the foot of his bed while he played a video game, back turned to you the entire time. You were 23, he was 17, and the broad burnt landscape of his neck and back was tattooed with dead boys' names, phoenixes, voluptuous anime warriors, and the Chinese characters for courage and dragon. He did not call you Jie Jie, older sister, anymore. You are lucky he did not call you worse. Bon courage, indeed, and let that dress rehearsal be a lesson to you. Who did you think you were? What was your love going to do? Where had you been? You were too late by a heap of raw years. You would not save him. The end of the world had already come and gone. And now I'll read a poem from the childhood section. So this is a funny coincidence, but the neighborhood that I grew up in, the development that I grew up in South Jersey, all the streets were named after poets, and there was an alphabetical order. Yeah. So it was kind of like fated that I would become a poet and not a doctor, disappointing my parents. But so the street that we lived on was Eaton Way. It was E. I believe it started with Byron, and then it was Chaucer, and then it was Byron, Chaucer, Dumas, and Eaton. And my elementary school was on Walt Whitman Boulevard. My best friend lived on Longfellow Drive. It's pretty amazing now that I think about it. It was called Cherry Hill, New Jersey. It's a suburb of Philly. I don't think I've ever seen any other development with poet names. Yeah. So this is the house on Eaton Way. Now that I have my own children, I understand better that shade of years in the white house with green shutters, flanked by unruly firs, the termites consuming our foundations. A house of women and my father, each with their separate labor, their own wages of doubt, their hard-won English, a well of pebbles and willful ceramic shards. My nainai slept and raged downstairs, nursed my nosebleeds with raw egg, then began to lose her sight. In time, she could no longer discern the long-haired blonde boys from the girls. Every year, her guard lower and more porous. They came frequently now, shoulders shy and hunched in our airless dining room, while our parents were gone, unaware. I remember their outstretched arms like lifelines, their good mouths as polite as snow. And then I think I'm gonna end with Reputations, which is also in the growing up or childhood section. Reputations. You should know he might come sniffing at your dormitory door late one stormy May night, as hounds are wont to do. But this hound you know, and you're not even the least bit afraid. You can hear his fingers rifling in from the whinge and bang of your mail slot, because your vaunted halls are archaic like that. Bronze stars nailed outside the windows of rooms young men decades before left abruptly to answer the call of their dying. Gothic doors so heavy they leave you breathless. Down the hall, your good girlfriends will try to steer him away. She's asleep, you'll hear them hiss, feigned conviction thick. You should go home, you're drunk. But of course he doesn't. He'll chant your name like it's sport until you let him into the railroad car of your single. Desk here, chair opposite, width of your room, the long twin bed exactly. And there the two of you will crawl, moles groping the dark dirt of each other's bodies, his curls damp with weather and beer. How unfortunate that tonight you chose the circus-striped nightshirt. But lucky at least for your favorite white cotton underwear, panel of lace where it matters. And so it is here that he finds you, under a string of technicolor lights hotly blinking. And how he finds you. You allow yourself 1, 2, 10 minutes, throat bared, heart racing to God, before the faraway trial of easy stops you dead. No, you can't indulge a need this good, even if it arrives on a room service platter and overtakes your soft welcome bed, or presses its mouth to your door, all mischief and fresh black rain. You're just a pretty girl, and hounds, you've learned, do talk. Thank you so much.
That was Deborah Kuan reading at the Noah Webster House, West Hartford, Connecticut, on June 10th. Charles Hartman's reading followed. Hartman has published several collections of poetry, as well as books on jazz and song, and, as previously mentioned, computer poetry. He is poet in residence emeritus at Connecticut College and is guitarist in a jazz trio. It's an honor to present Charles's work here.
Thank you all for being here. Been enjoying sitting here and listening to all these poems and realizing again how much I love images. It's just so much fun to have people put these things in your head. You know, for free. Wow. I have a newly completed manuscript, a new book that is not a book yet, and I'm going to read mostly from that. But I want to go back and read a couple of poems, three poems, I think, from my new and selected poems, which is getting to be very old by now. It came out in 2000-something anyway. That helps. So I'm going to start with three poems, three older poems. The first is called Maybe So. We have a little time here and are so small it can seem endless. We begin by seeing the light, which is too bright, and end in seeing it go too dim. Between we have jobs and babies, opinions, loads of opinions. We have friends, lovers, and we learn how little our opinions mean because of them. We discover fear and take years to grow intrigued by it, find out how live we are on the edge of the bridge. We discover love and recognize it as fear. Between, we ask what the agenda is. The agenda is the end, never mind. And the light, every day from its beginning and ours, sometimes more, and sometimes less, comes back to begin us over. Just when we think we knew the front yard's routine, arrives the cardinal, too, the bright tangerine of her beak, the only thing in the world her wide eyes can't see, the pick of his chirp slung over and over at the rock face of the morning, that blank chert he exposes garnets in. We shake our heads and go off to work because work is what we do, and that is its definition. You know this. I know that. We have a little time here. We stockpile batteries and pens, saxophone reeds for some, for others, sheep. It's all to the good. They tell us it won't count. We know what counts. Maybe it's even because of all we've done that a kiss comes in the middle of an afternoon. Not a new kiss, if that means new lips, new shoulders rounded into our awkward arms, but still a kiss that stops time for us, stops us short on the bridge, as if it had got rid finally of its end and its beginning. We remember that, even at the end. We remember that beginning when the light looked over our shoulder and made us memorize every leaf, every feather, every fear we came to love with, and the love. sometimes you get to dream a poem and you wake up and you have to find a title for it. It's hard work. In this case, I dreamed a title and woke up and had to find the poem for it. And the title is Tuxedo, Nocturne. Sleek light make black car body open, a pool, a pearl, a downtown fool, a net sulfur corridor, one avenue to sue that deft umbrageous moon, a half kilo uncut opprobrium, razor dressed, cough up a waiting game simper and hunk mean, a man with a mictive countenance, amen, and two legs. Tux, tuxedo, eat lux, deluxe. Water flow, go easy down past a high time stream. Easy down Korean, Uzbek, Mississippi shoe repair and novelty market. Down a tendon, a brick armpit, a high press bridge, a Bardic white gilt apse of grime. Go hotel glass, so clean, gigantic, a car roll in hole, glean class. Down block so chock with radio flock at wake cock and shake frock. Around you, dressorama, fancy one, video conception, sweet conception, mama, live in a drum, subscribe that da-da beat. In a dream, go down, weigh you undawn bundle of city news anon, go down, tux, tuxedo, eat lux, deluxe. Mr. Fist Twister, sit a bumper cop, pose atop fender, nose up a golden wrist. Curb this herb present, hands on a chromos or chromic bastion, aghast in a haunt night. You trade war fancy boy and general cream idiom, stand in patent skin for significant American experiment, music suffisant to be felt up earlobe, dotted line endwise, suicide under you hood, American experience par none, you cagey grill cut loose, a cat lick smilette, hey rat, hey maze master. Gambado and Falcade, Courvette and Capriole up a countryside, thy flanks amuse. Tux, tuxedo, eat lux, deluxe. Quick, identify one right front valve lifter from cylinder 5. Heat up, say, eat up, say, caseload casserole. He don't know dick about overhead cam. He don't have clem cluelet. He monk a rambunctious perspective. He shine elsewhere if he shine at all. He built on a sandbar. He tilt a whirl on a handlebar. He fail bail and trail one aileron. He a main mess all piss and shoelaces. He Chevy Nova chop shop stoolie. You say it. Say, officer, my officer, you bum breath, off speed knave in a blue shoot. Say, diminutive of test, his testicle. Hey, tux, tuxedo, eat lux, deluxe. Quicksilver, give us dog replevin, give roach hypothecation, take off this neck brick and wang warrant, make us a morsel parcel, a cummer bundle with no cunctation, a timely lunch apropos that long umbilic road. We sense Lex Loci and his bandy boys. We riding a line on a shot cuff and a hand sign, mama studs and shirt tails, send us to college. I once found out in the most embarrassing possible way that in order to read that poem aloud, I had to stand up. One more old one called Shave. I'm thinking about how I shave my face because yesterday I shaved my father's for the first time. This sun's going to rise a little farther right now every day. Soon I will return to my normal life in another city, and the year will decay in an orderly fashion. He gestured me to cut off the mustache. I wouldn't. Everybody, I said, every damn body should have a mustache. Life is trouble. Later, I strode out looking for the car. One who can walks from the hospital. This mirror, I can't get it right. The edge of my eye comes and goes, watering. After a while, I know the days will turn back and walk north. I try to do what I'm told. My sneeze rings louder in my father's house. I pace his carpets on naked feet, one of his cigarettes in my hand. All the machines there hum and glow, warming up, ready with readouts. Outside his window, here, a mockingbird runs on for minutes without repeating, stops to consider her options, runs it exactly through once more. She does the wren, the crow, the creaking door. The sun gives up and lets go of the horizon. I turn the light off and the razor on, get back to work on a face I know, even in shadow. Poems now from what will be a book called Downfall of the Straight Line. Um, parts of which book appear to be spoken by things and people that would appear not to be me. Here's a poem called Donkey in the Air. While I stood as usual, they added stones to the back of the cart, presumably behind the axle. So, not suddenly, but at some tipping point, the market square began to fall away. Look at that bell tower. Who would have guessed? Meanwhile, the chest, supposed to hang from the firm arch of the spine, ached in harness. The clapper lulled. If I've been sure of anything, it's footing. Now I find less traction than a swimming dog. Could try what the birds do. No. You're gaping. I would too. I have a couple of ideas, which unfortunately involve hands. You capped fool with the camera, why not scurry to unload stones, return me to the useful earth? No, this is too much fun. Snap on, develop, print, make a postcard to amuse your tourists from Pakistan to Naples, till it slips into the fist of a Greek who will do a trick to transpose my hung, ridiculously elevated body into a picture of his own village to shame the locals. Then one of you can turn it into words, also good for bandying about. Always glad to be of whatever service in the quarry of your decades. At last, since nobody wants to deal with me dead, somebody starts lifting off counterweights. No plummet, just hind legs, a little kicking, watch the tail, then four, back in the belonging dust. That's settled. The pianos. This has an epigraph from The Grateful Dead. All graceful instruments are known. Amid so much sleep, we remember the waking phrases, iterations bored or rapturous, resounding hours, rehearsals of the opulent impromptu, the melody sketched by our right hand once and let drop. We almost remember the 100 hands, thousands of operations, fashioning us for the sleek showroom, the dim loft, the highly favored dorm, the not quite defunct club, solarium, atrium. Among us, we have taught some children what they are. Whether we're grand, the satin titan with mammoth underbite, or upright, but spinet is an ugly name. Everyone has a fallboard eyelid. We all need work. My felts haven't been pricked for years. The sostenuto's flabby. A long life can be ghastly, last decades in an untunable basement, peeling untouched even into noise. Once on a loading dock, Steinway CD 318 and I passed back to back, Gould's own, on loan to Evans. This was before the fall. Another I know stroked Tatum's fingers, then Peterson's, a junker by then with a fresh coat of paint. When Monks burned, everyone went dumb for a day. When I first came home, under the round window, even as I heard the truck's pads and dollies tucked back in while guys flexed shoulders for the next, on that still first morning, I answered Bach with Bach, and when at last she stood and away from me to speak to some others, I knew her heart was mine. This is called Assembly Square, and it's, as a subtitle announces, it's from Nafplio, the town in the mouth of the Argolid Plain in the Peloponnese in Greece. Not peace, but a picture of peace, or of where peace might touch down or spring forth, whatever peace does to arrive. Pines and palms, neat public polygons of local stone, benches, pavers grooved for a season when wet stone breaks ankles, all below the long ridge fortified so grandly the second time Venetians tried to hold the town, and heroes had names like Turk Eater. Any Turks now, migrants and refugees, stay low to avoid being eaten by anything quicker than economics. Tourism can't fix everything. As Satan, once Lucifer, myself am hell, was first to recognize, nor am I out of it. The square's citizens come and go, the mother pedaling steadily uphill as the child in back gazes everywhere, the six old men sagging in chairs in the cafe in the sun, the mothers and daughters lumbering bag-laden from the week's market. Doves hoot in 5-4, smaller, self-important birds chatter together, shreds of talk drift like smoke from the cafe, the chuckle of a starting car parries the slow surf of a passing one. Here I can sit idle, crossing my legs, which men don't much do in Greece because it might suggest balls smaller than cantaloupes. The biggest building across the green, headquarters of the neo-Nazi Golden Dawn, is not very big. Everything to scale, everything true to Euclid. I'm not sure what constitutes peace, but a mind either freed of darkness or filled with light, a light not very much different from what floods this square according to its own laws, the straight lines among all surfaces and the tinier adjustments that are color, would seem like a good beginning, an orange in the grass, in the shadow of a palm. And I'll end with three short ones. Well, some are shorter than others, what the hell. This one is called Moonlight, two separate words. Moonlight. Bless her who blessed us with this gift, this bauble, Pharos paraphrase of Earth's our satellite, a bubble, to make your room a fable of seeing through the night. This 3D printed globe, crater by crater true, minutely rough, as is no doubt the original to the soft hand of God, hankers to show us us. Who knew it was so light, that clinker in the sky, to rest its ounces on a wireframe cube of basswood? Who knew it had a button to switch from gold to rare blue and dim it too? We said this afternoon, looking ahead to night, last up turns out the moon. This poem is actually newer than the new manuscript. So it's the first of whatever the hell comes next, which I will find out someday, I hope. This distance. If you think you could hear the heat, it's probably cicadas you're remembering. At this distance, you don't feel it, don't be ridiculous. But you put together an angle of vision steeply uphill, and the raw rub of a backpack you gave up years ago, and crushed sage and time, and you are as there as you habitually are where you are. Down below, the sea must be a bathtub, so small are the boats, the smacks, catches, the ferry leaving along its long curve. The notion that you could be here and there is a difficult and necessary dilemma. As soon as you try to assemble words for it and realize you've taken them from two languages, you've lost it again and hold it as fast as anything, any moment you can grasp. Last poem, I made a city. I made a city walled in wood and set it in the sea. I named the flood our gravest good and surety. We watched the clouds that are, and read the wind for way, living the near to learn the far of the last day. Storm rains cuneiform on wave recorded our long lore, so all we gave we might yet have if we reached shore. I settled us on the tall hill where wisdom rests her soul, and the owl lit on the old sill and made us whole. Thank you.
Welcome back to Poet Radio, and I hope you enjoyed hearing Charles O. Hartman's reading at the Noah Webster House, recorded on June 10th. As mentioned earlier, Hartman is an active musician and will be closing out the program with a tune of his titled Ides of April. Thanks everyone for tuning into the program, and please stay tuned to WGXC Radio for open ears. Thank you.
Thank you.